Hey folks, this is Juliet. We're just giving you a little bit of a disclaimer for this episode, as something occurred with our mic while recording, and the quality isn't amazing, for which we apologize. Our sounds are a little bit muffled and tinny. I did my best to kind of improve the quality of the audio, as Leisha and I felt like if we were to re-record, we wouldn't be able to kind of recapture the quality of content that we did the first time around. So we once again apologize for the inconvenience and hope that you will bear with us and enjoy the episode. Thank you.
Hey, this is Leisha.
And this is Julia.
Welcome back to Screen Tea Podcast. Dancing. She kept it going this time. Hi.
It's becoming a response that when we start a yawn.
Oh. Is this like your Pavlovian response to recording this podcast?
Oh. No, my response is stupid.
Oh. I was going to say, Maya, tell me how you really feel. It only took you to episode 28. Not a bad run.
I guess not.
Do I have to find a new co-host in a pandemic?
It's all you, baby.
I swear to God, your little bat stuffed animal just moved.
He's volunteering. Fruit Loop was volunteering.
Out of the corner of my eyeball, I was like, oh, there's a cat in the room. I looked.
What is it with us thinking that there's cats in the room when there aren't?
Because we have 5 cats in this house, and there usually is, statistically.
Yeah, so welcome to my life with thinking things are moving.
I've also gotten how many hours of sleep in the last, like, 36 hours? 2? Roughly? Roughly? Shit. What are you drinking today, dear?
I'm drinking... This word is so fun. I'm drinking cranberry rooibos.
Rooibos?
The word is rooibos.
Ah, okay.
Rooibos.
Rooibos?
I had to, like, look it up.
Cranberry rooibos. Nope. Cranberry. Wait.
Rooibos.
That's what the tea is called now. Cranberry rooibos.
We're fucking dumb.
Now I can see why you wrote it out the way that you did, because that's different.
Yeah, I mean,
cranberry rooibos.
Rooibos.
I did it. Okay. Yeah, we got a new Sips by box today.
Yeah.
Yesterday, and we've been drinking, and it's fun stuff. I'm drinking cucumber mint mojito.
That's good. I like anything mint.
I like anything mojito.
I like the spicy cold.
I hate that. The cold spicy.
Yeah.
The cold spicy.
The cold spicy, excuse me.
The spicy cold. The cold spicy cold.
No, I just burnt my lip.
I also heard you smack your tooth on your cup. That all of that was really unpleasant.
Because I burnt my lip and like jolted, so I hit my tooth.
I want to hear that, please.
Tink, 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 tink. So I wonder if the mic picked it up.
My question, and the first 3 minutes of this episode being complete nonsense, is can someone explain to me how we now have over 500 downloads? Anyone? Anyone out there?
It's like one person just continually clicking.
Kane, is this you?
It's Kane. We joke that we make the podcast for ourselves and our friend Kane.
Kane, we love you. You do, and we miss your face so badly.
I was just telling him he had to visit, and that, like, he could bring his PlayStation, and he could play online, and I could live through him,
as he plays with our Discord friends.
Welp. Or you could just come visit and never leave. Ever.
Yeah, I mean, initially when we moved here, I told him there's that room over the garage that he could live in.
Oh, I'm convinced that, you know, just drifters come and live there. That's what comes in my mind at 4:30 in the morning when I can't sleep and I'm convinced someone's going to murder me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Living, or it's a bear up there.
Living in the mountains, you know, in Virginia, in the woods. Yeah, that's where I go. But anyway, whoever is listening, because there has to be more than just you, Kane, thank you so much from the bottom of our weirdo little hearts. I thought that was amazing. That made me tear up a little bit when we hit that.
It did, I saw you.
Yeah, we hit that number. It was pretty fucking cool. I was really pleased and happy and overwhelmed, and then simultaneously horrified at the fact that my voice has been heard 500 times. I had a moment of panic. So, but yes, and now as we're sitting here, just...
You're a therapist. Yeah. People listen to you speak all the time.
That's different. I listen to them speak.
They still have to listen to you speak?
On occasion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, this different. Let's get into this, shall we? That was my long, convoluted way of saying thank you.
Spronk.
Spronk. So, this week, let's get into it. I'm going to give a little bit of a prelude to our real question because it ties into our movie, as it usually does. We are covering a pretty well-known director's directorial debut, which leads us into this week's real question. This week's real question is, what is your favorite directorial debut? To kick us off, we had a response. I knew this would be a hard one. It's kind of a very specific question.
Meals.
So, thank you, Sandy, for answering on the Facebook group. And her response was Ben Affleck's directorial debut with Gone Baby Gone, which is a good answer. I like that movie. I like Ben Affleck as a director. You're giving me, like, a blue screen of death look on a human face, and it's really disconcerting. Look, I've shown you, that's the movie, I showed you that movie, because I wanted you to see his, like, directorial style. Didn't I show you The Town, too?
No, I don't recall any of these movies. I have not seen The Town.
I did show you Gone Baby Gone. This is a problem. Anyway, thank you. That's a good one. That's a good choice. What is your favorite directorial debut?
We actually covered one of my favorites, and that is Shaun of the Dead. Edgar Wright's feature directorial debut is Shaun of the Dead. And then my other one is Rian Johnson's feature directorial debut, Brick.
That it was my immediate, like, gut reaction as to what you
said. I'm apparently a dum-dum and didn't realize that was his debut.
I thought I knew that. I
thought he had something before that.
I knew that was his feature.
He had a couple shorts before it.
Yeah, I mean, these are definitely going by kind of feature film in theaters directorial, because most directors have, like, their student films, their shorts, their things like that. But my immediate, I knew my response before, this has always been, because it's always been my favorite Tarantino film, and that's 92's Reservoir Dogs. Probably will always and forever be my favorite Tarantino film. And that was his feature film directorial debut. I remember that when that came back out in the theater, when was that? Was that 2012? It may have been. They did like a, was it 30 year? I can do math. Yeah, it would have been 30. Nope, 20. How many years?
I have no idea.
92 to 2012. 92, 2000. Yeah, 20. Thank you. Math's terrible. Yeah, they had it back out in the theaters, and I got on, like, my suit and with my tie and my sunglasses, and it was really fun. It was a blast. And then
I don't think I've ever dressed up for, like, any movie.
Fucking A. That's
So lame.
You're not lame. Just that made me sad.
Sorry. I just rolled my eyes at her really hard.
You're not lame. I'm just a fucking nerd. There's a difference.
So many people dress up for things in general.
Uh-huh. Because we're nerds. Which isn't bad.
No.
Doesn't make you lame, though.
You made it sound like it was bad.
Makes you a little bit of just a normal person.
That's sad.
I think it's sad. I'm
very fucking weird.
I think it's sad because I think you'd have fun. That's why I think it's sad for you specifically.
Maybe when it's safe again and we can go to the movie theaters, even though you and I discussed that going to the movie theaters isn't as fun as you think it is.
Right?
Which is stupid.
It's not.
I think it's great. dress up. I'll make it fun for you.
Okay. Yeah. Post-COVID world. What's that? And then I would say my secondary favorite directorial debut would be Mike Flanagan's directorial debut was Absentia. That little flick that we watched on Netflix unexpectedly that wound up being fucking awesome.
Oculus?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was his debut.
No. Absentia was 2011.
Huh. Uh-huh. Either way.
Yep. Oculus was not him. Well, no, I like Absentia more than Oculus. Like
I know you do.
And his other films. My favorite thing he's ever done is The Haunting of Hill House.
I know.
However, I fucking love that movie. And when I saw that was his directorial debut feature length, I was just like, oh, fuck yes. Mm-hmm. That's a perfect example of how to do a debut. That movie stuck like on the inside of my brain.
Is that like the fourth movie we need to do for Halloween for October?
I don't know. I was thinking maybe Martyrs.
Really?
Maybe.
We were just talking about how that was probably too much for this podcast.
Martyrs?
Hmm.
Really?
Uh huh.
Oh, I forgot that conversation.
It's recorded.
Piff. That's doctored.
We're not behind this mic enough for me to doctor that.
Anyway, you're probably right. We probably did say something along the lines. Anyway.
I mean, I wouldn't mind doing it. We talked about watching it again.
I think, you know what? I think you're probably, now that I'm recalling Martyrs and all of its glory, probably correct.
We could still do it. Just, it'll have low downloads.
This is, what?
I've had a couple people be like, yeah, scary stuff, and like, and that sort of isn't my thing. I'm like,
October, though.
I don't have a problem doing it. Like,
I think we firmly established at least two.
Yeah.
Of our October.
Oh, maybe three, because I really want to do the one.
I already forgot it. My brain, love, is
afflicted
today. Afflicted. Oh yeah, Afflicted is really great.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably actually low key one of my favorites.
Because it was astoundingly surprising, and neither of us expected it.
No.
Anyway, this is not October, and this is certainly not a Halloween movie.
No.
Let's get into it.
Meow, meow, meow.
So, tonight we are covering You Can Count on Me, which was released in the year 2000 and was Kenneth Lonergan's directorial debut. You know Kenneth Lonergan as the director of Margaret and Manchester by the Sea and this, and that's it. He's only directed three films.
Mm-hmm.
You Can Count on Me was also written by Kenneth Lonergan. Some of his other writing credits include Analyze This, Analyze That, and Gangs of New York. He also wrote Margaret and Manchester by the Sea as well. The production companies involved in You Can Count on Me are Heart Sharp Entertainment, Capper Production, Crush Entertainment, and Shooting Gallery.
Some individuals that produced You Can Count on Me were Keith Abel, Steve Carlis, Donald C. Carter, Barbara D. Fina, Jill Footlick, John Hart, Julian Irigori, Robert Kravis, Larry Maestrich, Rachel Peters, Martin Scorsese, yes, that Martin Scorsese, Jeffrey Sharp, and Morton Swinski.
May I ask, what other Martin Scorsese?
Fuck, I don't know. There has to be somebody, other people named that.
There has to be, yeah.
Like, statistically.
I wonder, though, if they, like, just because of the, what is it, the Academy or the SAG or the SAG or whatever it is that determines, like, who can use what name. There's some kind of...
applies to
producers?
Does that apply to producers?
I don't know. I don't know. This is... I get to do research.
What's that?
Continue. Sorry.
I don't know. It's weird. It's an interesting question. Anyway, the DP was... I was literally having a conversation with somebody about this particular spelling of a name.
Kazmierski?
No. Steven. And or Stefan.
I always default Stephen.
I always purposely, pointedly, because I fucking hate the English language, default to Stefan because it's a fucking PH. Yes? Mm-hmm.
I always go to Stephen.
I know, and I come across the spelling as Stephen more often than not, and I hate it.
And it's also because I think I've only met one Stefan in my entire life, and it was an F-A-N.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was just funny that I literally had this conversation today.
I mean, this is a pretty common, yeah.
The
DP.
Stephen and or Stefan, Stefan, Kazmierski.
Jesus Christ. We are so sorry, Mr. Kazmierski.
They are known for Skins, Transamerica, and A Secret Love, which is a relatively new Netflix documentary. It was edited by a woman, Anne McCabe. I assume you're a woman by your name. If you're not, my apologies. They are known for Adventureland, Nurse Jackie, which is a TV show, and Can You Ever Forgive Me, which was a great movie.
Yeah.
The soundtrack and or composing was done by Leslie Barber. They are known for Seven Little Monsters, which is a TV show, Manchester by the Sea, and Late Night.
We have a wee bit of a movie to come. This movie in no particular order because, oh god, I hate when IMDb goes by...
appearance?
Yep. It goes by how the credits roll, and it's just all over the place. I hate when I have to copy-paste, find. It's just, yep. So, in no particular order, other than... order of appearance, I guess. This movie stars Laura Linney as Sammy. You know Laura from many things, including The Mothman Prophecies, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and Nocturnal Animals.
Sorry.
We have Rory Culkin as Rudy. You know him from Signs, Scream 4, and the TV show Castle Rock. We have Mr. Matthew Broderick as Brian. You know him from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Lion King, and Godzilla. We have John Tenney as Bob. You know him from Tombstone, the television show The Closer, and the movie Legion.
I was going to say that I don't remember him from my favorite TV show because it's not my favorite TV show. It's the movie that was funny.
It was a movie.
Oh, Paul Bettany.
And then we have Mr. Mark Ruffalo Mr. Rufo Ruffalo as Perry. You know him from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Zodiac, and Shutter Island.
I'm sorry. And what else?
The entire SMCU! Why?
Some of it. Because,
most of it. A large portion.
Anyway. That's funny. It's just, I feel like there has to be a fucking Marvel connection and everything.
I was trying to leave it alone, and you just did it. I literally did not mention Bruce Banner fucking anywhere.
I feel like some of the people that listen would be like, why the fuck didn't they say it?
This is
a weird time to try.
We covered a Mystic River, and that had Laura Linney. And so I'm trying to, when we have duplicates of actors, I'm trying to pull different films as the you know them from. Blah, 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 blah. And so
I'm sure that they appreciate.
I'm a Mario. It's a Mario.
You tried to make fun of me and you failed.
I just made fun of both of us. Give me partial credit.
Oh,
some actor notes.
I appreciate you trying to do that, but it's Marvel. You're the biggest Marvel fan I've ever fucking met. Like,
Actors notes.
Kenneth Lonergan plays Minister Ron in two major scenes counseling Terry at Sammy's house, and then counseling Sammy in his office. Since the director had a lot of dialogue in those two scenes, he turned over the directing to Laura Linney and Mark Ruffalo, respectively.
I will say, the amount of time and effort that it took both of us for Juliet to get through reading that actor note, fucking incredible. And I wish we had a blooper reel. Holy shit. You just killed that. In a way I would not have been able to.
What do you mean I killed it?
In a really good way. Oh. I was trying to hold my shit together when you were reading it. Ooh, my lord.
Did you notice how I...
The director?
Yeah.
You did real good, baby. All right, moving on. This was Rory Culkin's first major movie role. I know. Kenneth Lonergan was impressed, on the whole, with his acting. That's a really weird thing. Phrase. Kenneth Lonergan was impressed on the whole with his acting ability, but had such a difficult time getting him to laugh or even smile on camera that he had Mark Ruffalo tickle him a few times.
That's fucking adorable.
Right?
He seems like our kind of people. Mm-hmm. Matthew Broderick, a friend of Kenneth, was the first actor to be cast in this movie. He visited the directors at his apartment, read the part of Brian, and asked if he could audition for it. Lonergan then told him the part was already his. I'm never going to say this dude's last fucking name ever a fucking again.
Juliet can't say Lonergan.
Lonergan. I can't, like, look at it. It's like the salmon thing. I can't look at it. Because I'm going to say it fucking wrong. How many times can I say fuck this episode? I dare somebody listening to count and let us know. I won't check.
There was a St. Patrick's Day when a friend and I made green boozy bears. The gummy bears soaked in vodka. And we ate one for every time the word fuck was said in The Departed.
Oh, I know what friend this is in.
We were nearly dead by the time it was over. Good lord. All right, so the budget for You Can Count on Me was $1.2 million United States dollars. Little baby budget. It earned back $11.2 million USD.
Nice.
Reception, critically, very well. Rotten Tomatoes aggregate critic score sitting at a 95%, and Metacritic score of 85. Audience reception, Rotten Tomatoes audience score of an 88%, and IMDb score of a 7.5.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Some interesting toys. Guys, folks, I'm in a mood. The scenes where Rudy Jr. walks home in the rain were filmed with the assistance of the Margaretville Fire Department, which used their trucks and hoses to create the rain.
At the 73rd Academy Awards, Laura Linney was nominated for Best Actress, and the film was nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
Laura Linney was nominated for 9 major awards that season for her portrayal of Sammy, of which she won 4. Mark Ruffalo won 2 awards of his 3 nominations for his portrayal of Terry. I almost said that fucking wrong because I was looking at Lonergan. And Kenneth Lonergan, won 12 major awards for writing in our direction.
I'll have you know, I painstakingly counted the nominations and wins for the awards year that year.
That sounds like
that fact. It was actually, yeah, a little bit of a problem.
Yep.
In one scene, Sammy and Terry are talking outside and the moth flies into frame. In a 2016 interview with Rebecca Mead for The New Yorker, which I'll link in the show notes, Mark Ruffalo stated, "I've been in scenes with actors on other movies. If a moth flies into the scene, they kill the moth. It's a nuisance. It's not acceptable. But in this scene, we continue the scene because we know that we are living moment to moment with the kind of openness that Kenny wants us to have with each other, listening and responding. We say yes to it, it lands on my hand, and we just continue talking as it's walking on my hand. And then it flies away again. It was probably one of the most profound moments I have had as an actor, where the world collided with the work and it was seamless. Afterward, Kenny came running over and he said, 'Oh my God, the moth.' And he was so happy." I really wanted to include that because that's the take that they use.
Right.
And it's just a wonderful little thing to know that was not CGI and it was not intentional. So
Big sparks. Runtime, 1 hour and 51 minutes. Total of 111 minutes. Sound mix is Dolby Digital. Pop quiz, who remembers what that means from the last episode? Find out in the notes. Or listen to the last episode. Aspect ratio is 1.85 to 1. That's your standard widescreen. Camera is the Panavision cameras and lenses. It doesn't specify. That could mean blocking anything. Negative format is 35 millimeter Kodak. Cinematographic process. I almost did it. It was spherical. And printed film format was 35 millimeter. Yeah. Cinematographic process. Lonergan.
You did it.
Just
call him Kenny. Super bros. Super, you know, informal. Ken.
I actually prefer
Kenneth.
I like the full name. Like, I like Benjamin. I like Thomas.
It depends.
William.
On what the person likes.
Well, yeah, for sure. Whatever the personal preferences, but like just sound-wise. Yeah, aesthetically, I prefer...
Yeah, I get that.
Full names.
Like, I'm sorry, but on my fucking dead body, will I ever refer to Robert Downey Jr. as Bob?
That's just funny.
I won't do it.
You will refer to him as RDJ.
Well, yes, because that is his name.
Yes. It's not an acronym. Is it
RDJ?
Yeah.
Isn't it, though? His initials?
It's his initials.
Yes.
It's not his name. Bob is technically his name.
His nickname.
So what, RGJ?
RGJJ? Tell me what you think about your best friend, Ken.
Okay.
I'm gonna edit, like, half of this shit out.
No, it's nothing's getting cut. You get the this raw the file. Episode.
Oh, God. Oh, God, kill me now.
Alright. Direction. Having only watched Manchester by the Sea and kind of... comparing the two for a moment, I still feel like I can say that this feels like Kenneth's style that I could have guessed, even though I'm bad at picking out director styles, I know, shame on me, that this was his, that this was a movie directed by him. And this is interesting, I can't talk, this is interesting having watched his latest film first, and then his debut after.
Mm-hmm.
He's known for writing realistic dialogue, which is impressive, knowing that he generally makes his actors stick to the script verbatim. However, without Leisha informing me of this, I had not known, nor would I probably have watched Manchester by the Sea without her. It's not... I shouldn't be sorry. It's not something that I probably would have... that would have stood out to me, as I'm such a visual person. I pay attention to the cinematography first, and I wish that the shots matched the level of the writing, which I feel it does more so in Manchester, so yay for improvement.
I feel like you just read me, like, the flap on the inside of a book.
That's interesting.
It's not a bad thing. Huh. Like, that was a nice little compact summary.
Well, we know that I'm good at being direct.
Yes. No, that's not a critique at all. Like, I didn't just
think, oh. That's interesting, because I felt like when I was writing it, because I wrote... we've been in the habit of, like, writing our notes really haphazardly, I feel, the last couple episodes, or at least I have. I wrote these in, like, it in chunks, and then, like, went back and wrote, like, writing a book, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And doing the research for this film, I did a lot of research. I found myself just, like, reading a lot.
I'm gonna interrupt you and be like, this is very much... a you movie.
Oh, yeah? What's that mean? Pray tell.
Characters.
Uh-huh.
And Mark Ruffalo.
Characters and Mark Ruffalo. Isn't that every Mark Ruffalo movie? That's a movie. Characters.
Get out. Read your thing.
I wasn't actually being snarky.
Snark. I was.
Anywho. In doing the research for this film, of which I did a lot, I found myself becoming a bit obsessed with Kenneth Lonergan. I'll link to some of the interviews and exposés that I read about him because they were really fascinating. A few things that I learned, particularly reading the New Yorker article that I already referenced by Rebecca Mead titled, quote, "The Cinematic Traumas of Kenneth Lonergan," end quote, from 2016 and from an interview that Lonergan completed with Daniel Dirksen for The Writing Studio in 2017, is that Lonergan is meticulous, values the nuances of natural dialogue, and trusts his own skills as a writer enough to know when he wants his actors to stick with the script that he's written, as you kind of mentioned. This dude, having watched the three films that he's both written and directed, is a force to be reckoned with when it comes to creating characters that feel like actual living human beings interacting with each other. This is a director that knows how to siphon incredible performances from his cast in order to bring alive a story from paper to screen, and I'm kind of preparing myself a little bit to go down a Lonergan spiral at this point, not gonna lie.
Okay.
Be prepared. We've recently talked about how, like, yeah, Manchester was like a one and done, never gonna rewatch. Get ready for it, baby.
I think I've told you numerous times to watch it without me.
And you've not seen Margaret.
No.
So get ready for that as well.
I'll see Margaret, I haven't seen it yet. I don't know what's in store for me.
Margaret,
I know what's in store for me with fucking Manchester.
Yeah. Margaret was a requirement for me because it had two out of my top three at the time. It had Matt Damon and Mark Ruffalo.
Which is still fascinating to me that they don't interact in that movie.
I don't think they do because one was a bus driver and one was a teacher. Hmm. I don't think their scenes overlapped at all. I could be wrong because I watched it once. In like 2014 is when I think I watched it, but I don't think they overlap.
Okay. So,
anyway. Tell me what you thought of the writing.
Weirdly, I liked the...
You liked it, did you?
I liked the... Amos didn't laugh, damn it. The intro car crash. Much more when it was sped up, but not so much when the cop had to tell the babysitter the news. So, like, I liked the scene... sped up. I like the car crash sped up, but I didn't like when the cop comes sped up. Like, I preferred the speed. I really liked the way that that scene was handled, of the cop coming to the house and telling, you know, notifying the babysitter, because the audience knows what's up, and you can tell on the girl's face that she knows what's up, and we don't need to be told. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be spelled out anymore. You know, action, I told you this, actions speak louder than words, so to speak. I don't know, and I think when the very first time I watched it, I even, like, was like, I really liked how that was done. Because we always, I feel like we always get told, like, the bad news, so we always have to, like, relive and be told immediately after this thing happens that this thing which is annoying. So it was just, I don't know, that was really refreshing. I really thought that was a highlight.
Yeah, you imagine, because we would have had to have seen it, heard it, and then seen the kids at the funeral. Like, it would have been like, boom, boom, like, okay, I'm already sick of, like.
Yeah, that's just too much, especially to, like, start off with. And when this really bad thing happened, and I don't know the name of the actor that plays the cop, but he did such a, you know... is very subtly funny, the way that he kind of was, like, trying to find the words to tell the babysitter what she already knows. I hate Sammy's boss. Just from the very start, I knew it would be weird with Bob. And with any scene with these two, I fucking hate it. Hate it. I hate the lunch scene.
Really?
I do and I don't. I hate the lunch scene with Terry and Sammy. Like, it's a well done scene, but I'm so uncomfortable and I'm so over it so fast. Like, I just want them to be done. Lunch is done.
I see.
Bye. Like, I don't need any more of this.
It's emotionally uncomfortable for you?
It's visually uncomfortable, just, like, the conversation is kind of uncomfortable, like, just everything about it, like, good job, I hate it. I don't want any more to do with it.
Interesting.
Like, they do great. I'll say it as many times as is needed. I never want to watch that scene again the most.
Oh, I'm fascinated by that. I feel like, wasn't that, we watched the behind the scenes on the DVD, and Didn't Lonergan say that this entire movie kind of, like, sprouted from that scene?
I don't recall, to be honest. Sure, I was half paying attention to that.
Yep.
But that's interesting.
Yeah, it, like, started there and then expanded.
I wish that, I don't know about you, that I was given just a smidgen more, like, background information about people, which I know is purposeful, mm-hmm. but we know how I work and what I need when it comes to stories. I don't even need a lot. I just need, like, just a hair more about various people.
How often do you get that in real life, though?
I know. I'm aware that this is realistic. This is not quite my cup of tea, but for like this one of these reasons, like, I want to know more. But that's a good thing, though, right? That I would like to know a little bit more about various.
Yeah, I'm not challenging your note. I'm just like pointing out that in a way, your note, like you just said, your note isn't so much a critique as it is like a
observation.
Almost a note of praise.
Maybe. I mean, I'm like that in real life, too. Like, I'm a pretty nosy person. Like, I want to know things.
You're an Enneagram 5. For any of you who are listening,
that knows means, what that means. That still, like, means nothing to me.
For anyone who knows what that means, that should make sense. What you just said.
Anyway, we're going to have to talk about this again. I'm going to need it drilled into my head again.
All right, it's fine.
My last general note. I jump back and forth from liking and hating. I think I use hating a lot, and I don't actually mean that word, truth be told. It's the overall feeling of this movie, is, as we discussed outside of this, is kind of frustrating mm-hmm. and annoying. Annoying might be a more appropriate word than hate, to clarify. From liking and just being super annoyed with the siblings, I think I kind of end up on lukewarm at the end, though. They're both infuriating. Kind of partially examples of why I can't stand a lot of people, but this is such a nice example of writing and how well it imitates real life, as much as I don't like super super care for it. What is your face?
No, I just can't wait to tell you all of the ways in which I equated myself with both of the siblings.
That's hilarious. This will be fun. Because I love you.
Great.
You're like the one person I can stand.
Good note. Her face right now. It's like I doused her with ice water.
I'm also trying to like be up on the mic so you guys can hear me and I don't have to do too much editing with volume. Truth be told.
Like, not a bad way. The best note you could have used to lead in. Anywho. Alright. This is my overall general notes. Oh, shit. To kick off my writing notes, a few bits of my favorite dialogue, because the goddamn dialogue in this movie is so... Oh, it's a balance of being profound at times in a way that isn't pretentious or unnatural in conversation, while also most of the time being mundane without being disinteresting, making the characters completely three-dimensional and human. And anyway, here are my favorite lines of dialogue. So there's not too many, but the first one, this is the hot cuisine of garments. Love that line so much. Anyway, I was actually wondering if we could get more refreshments, actually. Okay, so here's my note on this. The double use of actually, and then also Terry's direct follow-up statement starts with actually as well. It's so nice because it's so fucking natural, and it hurts me. It's so good. Most writers, screenplay writers included, wouldn't dare echo so closely, so many times, so back to back, but we do that when we speak, especially when we're nervous. And when we watch things, we watch them with subtitles, and I feel like reading while listening makes it so much more pronounced when there's echoes, when there's speech patterns, things like that. And it hit me in a way that it hadn't in my previous watches before showing this to you. And it was just like, you know, actually, I was wondering if we could get, or actually, and then he starts, actually, I'm just like, that's how people fucking talk. I talk to people on a daily basis who are uncomfortable or are talking about uncomfortable things, and they talk this way. People are not written this way typically. And I was just like, oh my God, I love it so much. Because I thought about when I write and when people read it, and it's just like, well, no, you echoed. You echoed. You echoed. You used this word here. And I'm just like, holy shit. Like, my brain broke, basically, when I was watching this for that alone. Two more things that I really loved. And don't take the shot until you know you're going to make it, okay? When Terry is teaching Rudy how to play pool. One of those things that's just out of, like, in context, totally mundane. Out of context, totally profound. And another one that was spoken by Lonergan in the film to Terry is, I don't feel like my life is to the side of what's important. I just got chills, like, all up and down my arms reading that line out loud. I love that line so much. Just the lines, the dialogue, the screenplay, I can't find my own words to describe how much I love it.
It'd be interesting to kind of just, like, see this script itself.
And then some of the interviews and the exposés and shit like that I was reading, I think it was Casey Affleck talking about being in Manchester, was talking about how he was, like, reading the script, and there was a detail in there where he doesn't have a line of dialogue, but it's mentioned that he, like, grips this bag of groceries. And it was so mundane to him when he read it, and he was like, I didn't understand why it was necessary for it to be in there. And then he was like, but when we were acting out the scene, he was like, it just clicked. It made sense why I would do that. And just that one little action that some people might not even notice when they watch. And that, too, just reading that and then watching this movie the second time, I'm just like, holy fuck. The things they do. Oh, my God. Yeah, my brain. Like, Kenneth Lonergan has broken my brain. But moving on. What I absolutely adore about the way that this film is written and the arcs of the characters is that we don't see the typical character growth or resolutions that we're used to seeing in most films. I don't quite see these characters as having issues that are solvable or even meant to be solved. This is such a slice of life character study film that we are really getting a glimpse of these characters under a microscope, just during a moment in time when they just so happen to be engaging with one another. And we get to see moments of incremental realization that maybe they internalize and grow from. But in the end, we still see Sammy, a single mother, Rudy with an absent asshole father, and Terry yeeting himself away from his dinky hometown, kind of into an unplanned and unknown, exactly where we found them, like in the beginning. The only difference is that the story is written in such a way that we've seen them relate to each other and build deeper bonds, and there's kind of this tendril of hope as the screen goes black at the end. The story is so nuanced that it's damn near impossible to describe in terms of standard film storytelling.
Sammy seems like a wholehearted mom and then kind of gets whisked away. But that doesn't feel quite right. I'm not sure what to say about Sammy other than she seems a bit unhappy, or perhaps she's just bored. Hence the affair. But then she still has this other dude that she won't commit to either way, but still keeps him around. That all just seems depressing to me. And there's no saying, in my mind, that if she had left that tiny town, that it would have been any different. I don't know. I really don't know what to say about Sammy. It was like the last character I was kind of... focusing on, and yeah,
she was the last one for me too. She was the hardest for me as well. So there are things I like about Sammy and things that I don't like, which I think is the point of her character, for starters. And also what I think makes her such a great character. the qualities that I don't like in her are pretty subjective. I don't like her pushiness, some of her more judgmental qualities, or this undercurrent of cowardice that we see in her initially. And I think that kind of goes through with the affair and her inability to commit and know what she wants. However, digging deeper into these qualities, I feel like what I really don't like about her is that I see myself mirrored in her need to feel like she's in control of situations, which was her response to the trauma of losing her parents, being the eldest sibling. She has a routine. She doesn't like others to interfere. She doesn't like wrenches being thrown in to fuck things up. And this makes her rigid. And I can recognize this in myself. I feel like anybody who watched this film and cringed at Sammy could possibly benefit from some introspection. The things that I really loved about her were her abilities to continue loving others in spite of repeated instances of being fucked over, her ability to loosen up a bit. I loved the, you want to smoke some pot? No. Why do you have some? Like, just her ability in some instances to get over herself, so to speak. Eventually, yeah, like just her willingness to step outside of herself for 2 goddamn seconds and realize that she doesn't get to be the answer for everybody. She's not going to fix her brother. She realizes that. She's not the answer for her boss's fucking problem. She realizes that. And kind of in the end, I feel like we get to see the most growth from her out of anybody.
Yeah.
So, an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
What about Terry?
Mm. Whoops, Scott. Definitely thought he was like a crack addict or something when we were first introduced to him in his apartment with that girl. He's weirdly self-preserving, which is probably not the correct word that I want. As we all know, I really struggle with vocabulary, apparently. He almost just kind of doesn't know how to take care of or be responsible for anyone but himself. And there's also this annoying thing of, don't tell your mother, which irritated the ever-living fuck out of me. However, half the time he seems well-intentioned, but still fucks up and still kind of ends up making things about him when it shouldn't be about him. Like, with Rudy's dad, I think the one time where he doesn't make something about himself was the pool scene.
Mm.
He very much is like, Rudy won, you know, like, he praises Rudy, and Rudy kind of gets the, or Rudy Jr. kind of gets, like, celebrated as well.
Really? The one time? 'Cause I kind of see, like, the opposite, that the one time he really fucks up, well, he forgets him, the one, because he gets stoned, like, that's a fuck up, and when he gets into the fight with his dad, every other time he picks him up, he takes him to the construction site, he teaches him how to do something, he ends up following through and takes some fishing,
and thought that he tattled on him,
and then he apologized.
Eventually, yeah, mm-hmm. But he still initially, like, kind of made it about him and all this other stuff. I already talked to you about this, how I feel like he's a very roller coastery character.
I thought about that.
Yes.
What I love about this, and I think that this is a point also, is when you can watch a movie and just get, have a conversation with the person next to you and have totally different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that's happened a couple times, mm-hmm. and it's always potentially more entertaining for people, isn't it?
That's what I think. Yeah. Absolutely, I do. Yeah, you ready for this? I also hella see myself in Terry.
I feel like... Do your note on Terry. And all that,
I have an intrigue.
No, very... a succinct note.
When we were watching, like you just said, you asked me whether or not he has a mental health disorder because he's so up and down, and I couldn't answer because I didn't have enough to go on. It's possible, but it's also possible he's a dude who really takes things to heart, even if it wouldn't appear that way on the surface. In the beginning, he tells the girl he's seeing that he's not the type of guy everybody thinks he is, and we really see that throughout. I feel a connection to Terry when it's evident how hurt he feels when Sammy ignores his efforts to help her with the plumbing and calls a plumber despite him asking her not to. Does he respond accordingly? No. I mean, he feels bad and hurt, and he decides to internalize it and gets high instead of talking about it. But you can tell he's crushed and that he's extremely fucking sensitive, and I get that. I can also imagine that he would resonate with anyone who feels that itch to explore, to escape from feeling tethered to one place, their childhood, or their traumas, and this is also where I found myself connecting with him as well. One thing that I also really loved about Terry is the fact that they've written him with such a beautiful, expansive vocabulary to challenge the stereotypical wandering deadbeat stoner character. Mm-hmm. His word choices and the way he expresses himself kind of gives his true character away, and I really like that.
As different as the siblings are, I feel that they are very similar, despite, you know, veering off from one another. Growing up, you know, past a certain point, completely different in their adult lives. That was what my thought was.
I absolutely have some shit in my etceteras to say about that too.
I'm just hitting all of the things.
You are, yeah. Tell me about little baby Rudy.
Rudy was also a little hard to kind of write about, but I think that was in part due to Rory's acting, which isn't bad at all, and I can talk about that later. This kid is so smart and seems kind of lonely. I feel for Rudy. His mom obviously cares, but is currently caught up in a bunch of nonsense and is kind of neglecting him a smidgen, as he has his uncle somewhat helping out. However, apparently, I didn't finish this note, Terry gets caught up in his own shit as well, and I don't even remember what I was gonna say. He looks up to his uncle, and I feel like he, you know, gets let down by another adult figure. I wouldn't say a parent figure, because he's not really, whatever, either way. And it's just shitty for this poor kid.
I like the character of Rudy because while he's somewhat a stereotypical child character, he's also written with flaws, and they're not the stereotypical flaws that we typically see in children. I know. People speak in echoes. Fucking fuck. He's entirely too...
I'm not judging you. It popped out because we were talking about it.
Rudy's entirely too trusting. He's somewhat of a fair-weather kid and a bit of a grudge holder. These are attributes that exist in so many children because children are humans. And yet, when we see flawed children on screen, we typically see these kind of enormous behavioral issues or tantrums or really annoying habits. Rudy's written instead as a good kid with a big heart who is simply learning and adapting these traits due to his environment. And the nuances of his development play out so organically like this on screen.
Yeah. Brian. Brian. Brain.
Brain.
What is with closing the fucking door? The most passive-aggressive moron. I really just want to punch him in the fucking face. I don't feel sorry for him at all. Goodbye.
Brian's the one character in the film I didn't feel like I could relate to. And I don't say that to sound holier than thou. I really don't. Because I think that Lonergan and Broderick both did a fantastic job at creating a character who comes off as lost, tired, frustrated, and, again, very human. There was a piece missing for me, I think, and I don't know if maybe it was because the family characters were so incredibly fleshed out. Mm. I didn't quite understand a lot of Brian's motivations, and ultimately he felt a bit like a righteous, have my cake and eat it too, stick up my ass, kicked puppy dog.
Yes.
And to me, that feels like a really weird amalgamation of characteristics to try to relate to.
He's a weird tool. He's like a puppet. He's literally just a thing that another character gets to use for drama.
I had trouble making sense of him.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. Production
design. I don't know. It feels and looks like a small town in the middle of nowhere, and the people in it feel the same. Yeah. Sorry.
Couple notes. I love how they chose to use the studio apartment and the really rundown setup in the apartment when we were first introduced to Terry, because it's such a juxtaposition to the home that we wind up knowing he grew up in and to the home we see him choose to leave in the end. The design of the homes that the two siblings choose to live in really do a lot to show their differences and their choices, their comforts, their paths, and I think it was a really nice and subtle way to tell their stories visually.
I can see that, but I don't feel like I saw enough of what you're describing to have come up with that, and hence my vague note. Does that make sense? I don't feel like we have gotten to look at other, like, homesteads and other movies, and, like, I feel like I've gotten a better look at those places than I did here, if that makes sense. Like, I don't feel like I saw enough to get the personality of the houses.
Really?
Yeah. That took me a lot. That took me so much time to get there. It was formulating.
We only get a moment in Terry's apartment, but really, that you see the bed and the couch existing in the same spot. You know that they smoke inside. You see the kind of broken down lamp. You see the shit scattered all over the floor. Like, you can see, you get that sense in that one scene. And then you go to the house, you can tell what's been there since they were kids. Just the shit that it has been there since, like, the 70s, the 80s, the style and the sense.
None of that stood out to me at really? All.
Nope.
I kind of want to tell you to watch it again and pay attention.
But I don't want to watch it again. Someday, but not again right now.
Well, I wouldn't tell you to go pop it in right now, but like,
I'm going to pause this. We're going to go watch it again
mid-episode. I'm going to take a fucking nap. That's what I'm going to do. You enjoy. But I guess what I'm trying to say is kind of like, just because you didn't notice it doesn't mean that it wasn't there.
No, of course not. You make valid points. And I hope anybody listening to this does pay attention to the movie when they watch it.
I like how you, like, this stuff was lost on you and the video game stuck out to you.
Yes.
You have a note about that?
In my
photos. I'll leave it alone. Yeah. The use of wardrobe as well to show the differences in these two characters was brilliant. Sammy not only looks nice and clean, she looks uncomfortably so most of the time. Too prim, too proper, too perfect to be relaxed. And on the other hand, Terry not only looks like he's in comfortable and familiar clothes, but they're overly worn and even holy. The wardrobe shows that they're on totally opposite extremes of the spectrum, as far from each other as they can get, especially in that first scene and the lunch scene. They even have the conversation, and she looks like she has to sit a certain way so their clothes don't rumple, and his, like, collar is super stretched out and looks moth-eaten, and it's just, like, the visual of how opposite you're supposed to feel they are is just, like, so nice.
You zeroed in on so much in this movie.
I fucking love this movie.
As I spoke in my opening statement about how visual I am.
Last production design note. I love the location where they chose to film as the hometown. Depending on how they filmed, as you can see in the beginning when Sammy's driving through, and then you see toward the beginning when Terry's coming on the bus, depending on how they filmed, the use of music, the tone, the green scenery in Rolling Hills can either seem comfortable, beautiful, and homey, or really bland, boring, and suffocating. And I loved the malleability of the landscape. Cinematography.
Do you want to go first?
So well.
I actually don't have a lot, but I'll let you go first. Because I always somehow end up taking your
shit. You do, because I only notice basic stuff, usually. I'm awful, and I don't remember what it's called or if it has a name, and if it does, you can tell me. Mm-hmm. But I love when the camera bounces between two characters speaking to one another, and even though only one is on screen at a time, they're still shown on opposite sides of the screen.
Charming.
Yeah, is it just, I know it's a really basic, like, framing tool to use. This movie utilizes those kinds of shots multiple times, and I just really like how we get to fully focus on each character while never losing the intimacy that's occurring between them during the conversation.
It feels like a conversation.
Exactly.
Like, coupled with editing.
Yep, yeah. I love that. Just, it's not just center frame, center frame, center frame on their faces, it's... We're on Terry, he's on the right side of the screen, the left is left blank, and now we're on Sammy, she's on the left side of the screen, and the right is left blank, and it just feels like they're, I really love
it. There was a movie that we watched where this was very specific, and it really stood out to me, and I can't remember what movie it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I love a lot. I really love the use of longer, continuous shots. Not only do they require stellar performances and delivery of dialogue from the actors, but they also make it so that the audience doesn't have the ability to escape.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, like, that lunch scene being uncomfortable, and I don't think that wasn't one long continuous shot, but
there were long shots.
There were, yeah, and I like the thought of they can't escape this moment, and neither can you, motherfucker.
Neither can the other people eating.
And just my favorite shot. I really love the shot of Terry and Rudy fishing with their reflections in the water. It's really just a simple shot, but lovely and mm-hmm. pretty and aesthetically pleasing.
I really like the shot of Sammy sitting on her bed with her back to us, with the mirror in the corner showing her from the front. Just, you know, using mirrors can be really hard because you have to make sure that, you know, crew isn't in the shot, mm-hmm. crew's not reflecting in the mirror, and, you know, camera's not in the mirror, and it's just, you know, it can be hard, and a crossover can kind of, like, yeah, just angle yourselves, dumbasses. Mm-hmm. It's just always impressive to me, though, because so much thought does have to go into it, even if it's an easy setup. I really like the shot of Terry apologizing to Rudy. He's very blurry in the background, but you can obviously tell that something is up, that he, like, wants to say something, because you can tell that he's agitated, even though he's not even remotely in focus. And then right before he speaks, it kind of very quickly snaps, and he snaps into mm-hmm. focus, and then you get the apology that you might not necessarily expect. So it's a lot of, like, it's a lot hitting you at once, and it's really drawing your attention to him and basically screaming, look at me, pay attention to me, this thing's happening. There are a fair amount of scenery shots that are very lovely. They're quite nice. I just don't particularly care for how they're utilized. It's the editing.
Editing. Since you have more to say than I do, because I really struggled, and I verbalized this to you, with finding things to say about editing, I really don't think there was anything spectacular about it. Or really bad, in my opinion. It seemed relatively straightforward chronologically, nothing untoward as far as transitions or cutscenes. Pacing was fine, length felt fine, everything I can think of concerning editing just felt fine. Like, that's the word that kept coming when I was trying my note, is like, it was fine. Like, it didn't seem extraordinary, and it didn't seem like, ooh, that was a bad edit, or like, ooh, they need to stop fading, because I don't think they did any fades, but like, yeah, well, yeah, like, there was,
I feel attacked.
Like, yeah, you should. but it's just like, no, editing's fine.
What was the point of Mark Ruffalo in the tub?
I have a note about that.
that's just, like, that's a quick editing note that kind of plays into my next one.
I have a thought, if it's honestly a question.
Okay.
And my thought is, when you come home to, like, your childhood home and the things that you do for comfort, I'm not wondering, like, that's, like, one of the first things that he does. That's, like, isn't that the first place that we see him, or one of them?
I believe so, yes.
Is, like, one, is the studio apartment that he lives in doesn't have a tub big enough for him to be in. Is this a home comfort? Like, I'm going to go home and relax and be mm-hmm. here and make myself comfortable and cozy in a bubble bath as a grown-ass man.
Well, we have no idea if it was a bubble bath.
Do we not know? Mm-hmm. I'm imagining a bubble bath. And, well, I don't
good
know.
For you.
Well, I might just be my imagination. I have a corny-ass note about this. Nothing that I'm saying right now, but after I wrote my note, I was just like, something about that scene, do you see him and Sammy have, like, this really tense scene together, and then you see a grown adult man who looks kind of dirty and uncomfortable relaxing in this giant, like, bathtub in his childhood home. And I'm just like, that to me screams of, this is a childhood comfort.
That's an interesting perspective. I would argue that he does not seem relaxed to me, that he seems very kind of anxious. But anyway, the pacing felt off to me. It was a bit off for me. I feel like there were a lot of extra shots and scenes here and there that weren't necessarily needed. And they were just there to kind of rub and kind of push the fact into that these people aren't perfect and sort of make you, like, feel, for a lack of a better word, what's going on in these people's lives. And it felt redundant to me. And that may just be my personal preference of not wanting to feel this level of uncomfortableness, or that some of the writing in this movie just isn't my jam.
Is that a writing or an editing note?
A lot of these go hand in hand, I feel. Like movies do. Because editing is like visual writing, in a sense. It's visual storytelling. What I do like, coupled with cinematography, is that when they're waiting for Terry to show up, before he leaves and is hella late, but we, you know, we get this dialogue beforehand that he has to be there before 8 a.m. and we get shots of the clock shown slowly counting down, and you can just, like, you can feel the tension that's happening, and we get the cuts, so, you know, we can tell that time's going by, he's still not there, and it's just, I like the visual storytelling in this very short sequence of shots.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really nice. Music. We're both gonna say it because I have a note about your picky ass, so go ahead.
I fucking hate the repeating strings part. And Leisha, I don't care about your counterpoint. Just kidding. What's your counterpoint?
Yeah, we both knew.
Other than that, the music didn't stand out too much to me.
I was honestly kind of fascinated by the mixture of kind of small town country twang, classical music, a little bit of rock. As you know, I obsessively search for the two Bach pieces used in the film while they played. And even though I know you were a bit annoyed by the repeated,
not a bit.
You fucking hate it. The repeated use of Cello Suite Number 1 in G Major, I really loved it.
I liked it the very first four times, maybe two or three times.
Oh, yeah.
And then I noticed it. I was like, fuck.
I want to know what I was wondering. Honestly, I was wondering if it was a repeated use or just a continuation
from
one solid playthrough. Right? It's classical music, so anyway.
I was in band. I know what classical music is.
Bitch, I found it. I was too. I found it mood appropriate when used, moving and really kind of sadly sweet, which I think was like the story itself. I also found it interesting that it was used the way that it was, either kind of repeatedly or split up throughout the film, because it's unusual. You don't get that a lot in films where the same track is used. I mean, you have certain instances where, like, you know, a character is listening to a song, like Into the Spider-Verse popped into my head. But
yeah, and you also have, like, you know, character themes.
This is not that. So yeah, exactly. I'm like, this is different. And different is intriguing. And I... See, you're right. In this instance, you and I disagree.
Yes.
And that is okay.
I guess.
Divorce. Tell me about Laura Linney.
Laura Linney, what else is there to say? We certainly get more out of her in this film than Mystic River, which is a relief because she's so fun and mesmerizing to watch.
Mm-hmm. I think that her performance in this film is an example of some of the best acting I've ever seen. Two instances when I was writing this immediately popped into my mind when I was thinking of how incredible she is. The first is toward the beginning when she and Ruffalo are in the car after the lunch scene. she puts her glasses on, has this really emotional moment, delivers this line, like something along the lines of like, I wish you would just send me an invoice. And then she takes her glasses off.
I made fun of her for that.
In such a...
But not, like, seriously make fun mm-hmm. of her. I just made fun of, like, this that stereotype action that happens in, like, dramas, like CSI. I'm sorry. Anyway, she was great.
You just compared her to What's His Bucket from CSI Miami.
That's not necessarily, like, a her critique, but, like, you know, Lonergan was like, yeah, do that. That's good. That's what I want.
It's not like he had a mic drop line or like ripped the glasses off and then delivered something. Yeah,
that's just what it made me think of. Fucking culture.
Laura Linney in that moment just like breaks my heart. It quite literally feels like I'm watching someone scramble to hold on to their composure, and there's nothing I can do about it as the audience. The other moment where I lose my mind is when she's in the car after one of her, like, hotel trysts with Brian. She's fluctuating between, like, laughing and making these sounds of, like, self-admonishment for what she's done. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And the thing that I keep thinking is there's no one else who could have made that scene feel that way. Mm-mm. Holy shit, I love that scene so much. By the way, Julia Roberts won the Oscar that year over her for Erin Brockovich.
Oh, well,
but, I mean, to that I say, nah. That's my opinion. Mm. Erin Brockovich is a good movie. Mm-hmm. Julia Roberts is a great actress. Mm-hmm. I think this was a better performance.
You know my feelings on award shows, so.
I mean, yes, but this is my judgment.
I know. This is like, I have nothing further to add to that because I don't give a fuck about award shows.
I just get to see all of the people I love.
And yeah, that's nice. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It can stop there. Just like, show all of the people.
Y'all just come have a party and send me the camera and go home.
Bye. Who cares about awards? Everyone has to buy their way in anyway. Rufo Ruffalo.
Mr. Rufo Ruffalo.
Much like any other Mark Ruffalo. Rufo Ruffalo role. Yep. I'm going to leave it. I definitely don't think of any of his other roles as he always becomes the person that he's playing, that he's portraying, and they're all so very different from one another. He's very quiet in this movie, and yet he has those moments where he explodes, and while the character might be feeling a little out of control, you can tell that it's very precise what he is doing with his voice and his body at all times.
I feel really emotional about Mark Ruffalo's role in this movie.
In general. Sorry. Okay.
His performance is widely regarded... His performance in this movie is widely regarded as his breakout role. The role that got his name out there in Hollywood. And it's so incredibly easy to see why Mark is such a natural performer in that you can watch him engage in what's happening around him on screen instead of simply regurgitating lines. This character is really there in the back and forths and the dialogue and the emotions of the moment. I watched this performance and it makes me want to cry because I can't help but think, this is one of those performances where I'm like, I can't help but think that this must have hurt him in some way. Mm-hmm. Because you can't just pretend like that. But then on the other hand, I'm like, well, I guess that's what a good fucking actor does.
Right? I was gonna say, that's his fucking job.
But, you know, actors do talk about how certain roles and performances mm-hmm. affect them, and I feel like this one just, like, it's... I wonder. Like, that would be a question that I would want to ask him. Like, did this performance have a lasting effect on you emotionally? Anyway.
That would be interesting, yes.
I owe Kenneth Lonergan just, like, years of fucking happiness because he trusted Mark with this role, and I owe Mark, of course, because he fucking killed it and got his name out there leading to the career he has now. Yeah. That I follow closely.
Religiously.
Not like a stalker.
Not even one. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. Rory Culkin. As I've mentioned to you, I fucking love that name. Oh, I'm surprised I haven't looked it up its meaning yet. I feel like I have. Anyway, I just don't remember what it is. I have a thing about names, guys. He's subtle, which I think can be really hard for a 10-year-old to maintain, which makes me feel a little bit like a loser, but not really, since Rory is the same age as us.
Yes, I have-
He was able to add a lot of small little details that made his character just that much realer.
Yeah. Yep. My favorite Culkin. this kid does such a good job, and that's a really bizarre thing to say because he's literally the same age as I am. Mm-hmm. He's right in between us.
Yeah.
Yep. With this being his first role, he carried a lot of heavy responsibility, mm-hmm. particularly in his scenes with Ruffalo, and he just did a perfect job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's hilarious that Mark had to, like, tickle him, though.
Yeah, to get him to not be so serious.
What kind of kid are you?
He has to be kind of scary, if you think about it. Like, you're
first. I mean, his entire family is performers, so, like, you grew up with that. But you know, I know
what that pressure might be like, though, to a 10-year-old.
Like, yeah, I know. It's just interesting. Like, we looked him up recently with his wife, and he was like, yeah, you really seem like our people.
Yeah, for real. Like, honestly. Honest to God.
Matthew. Good job making me want to punch your kind-looking and gentle-voiced face in about a dozen times. Yeah. I can't fucking stand you in this.
You had a moment that you loved with him, though. Do you remember?
Oh, when he's on the phone?
Yep.
It's just so absurd.
You loved that moment. You made a noise, and I look at you, you're just like, I just love Matthew Broderick right now in this scene. Like, I'm getting milk. Can I see you? And you're just like, I just love this moment.
So stupid. But it's almost kind of to, like, harken back to what you were saying about his character. Is like, you couldn't really, he's like a weird, what is the word you use, amalgamation mm-hmm. of different kind of characters. And it's just like, that was so far out there and hilarious, because I do believe that Matthew Broderick's a really good actor.
Yeah.
He's a varied actor, because there's that Netflix show that I love that he's in, and I just wasn't expecting him to play the part that he played, and I love that. It might be, like, my favorite role of his, to be frank.
What show?
Oh, fuck, what's it called? It's that zombie end-of-the-world show. I can't remember what it's called. I told you about it, yeah. But it's a little campy, so I'm not...
I probably wouldn't love it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think you would care for it, but it's got some nice things about it. Anyway, and that actually kind of, that scene kind of feels a little bit like that show. Mm-hmm. Just a little. And he's so deadpan when he's doing it. He's just, like, on the phone, bug-eyed, like, trying to convince his mistress to come see him. Hate his character. But he did great playing the twat.
Like, some of my disconnect with the character of Brian comes from the fact that I automatically associate Matthew Broderick with being fucking adorable. He's so lovable, and he can't act that association away for me.
That's interesting.
He's a fine actor. Like, he really is. I don't think he's extraordinary. I think he does well.
I think it depends on his part. He can do really well. Sure. It'd be interesting for you to watch that show.
Yeah, I don't. I am very upfront and admittedly, like, probably have seen very little of his mm-hmm. filmography. And he does the role justice, but, like, out of the main cast, I would say that he doesn't hit as high a note for me.
Well, I mean, yeah, like, you know, I would say the very first two are, like, grade A. Rory could potentially even be... Anyway, and then, like, you know, Matt would be like a low B. Mid B.
Good.
He filled the role.
Yep, there we go.
Et cetera. You first. What are the actual fucking bus stations? They don't. The last bus station might be a bus station, but I'm not convinced. And then, like, the first time Mark's character...
I'm not convinced! Like, you think it's a fucking conspiracy?
It's just the bus saw two people and was like, they might need a ride. And then, like, Mark was on the bus and was like, I gotta get off here. Let me pull the thing that this Greyhound doesn't have.
Maybe.
It's off the middle downtown! Like, I think both stops were, like, near a bridge, maybe. I don't know. That bothered me. I think I made a comment that someone watched it.
This is fantastic. It's my favorite
experience. And then, That better be motherfucking Pokemon Blue that Terry is playing at the dining room table. I even, like, had to look up, I googled Blue Game Boy game cartridges, and that was, like, the only one that popped up.
What year did that game come out?
That came out in, like, 96.
It had to have been.
And then I looked up, like, Pokemon games that came out in 2000. And, like,
didn't no, it had to have been. If this filmed in, like, anywhere between, like, 98 and 99, it had to have been.
I mean, possibly, yeah. The way that he was playing the game would indicate that he was not playing Pokemon, because that's not how you play Pokemon. I mean, yeah. If I were acting, however, I would be playing.
Second question for Mr. Ruffalo from the McCurry household. Was it, and were you?
Three questions all together. Fuck.
Oh, man. Are those your first?
Yes.
You kind of, you touched base on this in the beginning, but just like, what about Bob? Okay. Yeah, Bob was such a bland and boring character, which, intentionally, I was really bored with most of the scenes he was in. And yes. I was just really hoping and assuming that that was intentional. Like, that he just brings with him this drab sense of boredom, and that's why Laura Linney's just like, no.
Because he doesn't even, like, get mad at her. He's just very...
I think that's the point, is that, like, she can't weigh herself down with this super tepid relationship. She's just like, what is this? What are you doing, and why? And that's probably why. yeah, and I'm hoping it was intentional, because we were supposed to kind of feeling that along with Sammy. Otherwise, oh my god. Yeah. I can't express how much I love the dynamic between Rudy and Terry. You have a man who grew up without parents, who lacks an anchor, finding just that in this kid. And you have a kid growing up without a father, finding somewhat of a male role model in this aimless, imperfect man. But really, who else is better for the job? Like Lonergan kind of implies in the behind-the-scenes feature on the DVD, every parent is simply a grown-up child. And nobody is perfect, but at least for a little while, Terry is present, and Rudy provides an anchor. It's just really fucking beautiful. Every scene that they share is absolutely glorious. Just, I love that dynamic so much. Mega hella shout-out to the gratuitous showing off of Mark Ruffalo's bare chest. I'll swear until the day I fucking die that is written into his contract. He has to be bare-chested in his films. Or at least wear a shirt with a deep enough collar to show off that chest hair. This film has scenes of both in spades. Kevin Bless. Tell me I'm wrong, though.
I'm sorry?
Tell me I'm wrong. I pointed out every time we watch a Marvel film, because
it's kind of like how Will Smith has to be shirtless in everything he does.
That's a pattern I wouldn't know, because I don't watch that many Will Smith things.
I mean, that's like another...
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Oh. Yes. Didn't know.
Like, it's also like, oh, it's in his contract.
I see. I didn't know that. It happens with such frequency. It just, like, it's whenever we watch them, you're just like, there it is. Mm-hmm. Oh, there it is. Here we go again.
Or it's a movie you've seen, and I may or may not have, and be like, wait, it's coming.
Yep. You touched on this earlier. I honestly think this is the most honest portrayal of a sibling relationship I've ever seen on film. Their relationship shows two siblings that are similar in some ways, even though their personalities are polar opposites. In a cyclical relationship with one another, who love each other deeply, even when there are moments where they blatantly don't like one another. I love this depiction of an honest sibling relationship.
I even made a comment that some parts made me feel like my brother and I. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like I couldn't relate as much because the age gap between me and my siblings is so drastic.
Yeah.
But just... working with families, working mm-hmm. with siblings, seeing what most sibships are like right. I loved it.
I mean, I don't know what their age difference is, but Jordan and I are 6 years.
Yeah.
Which, depending, like, when we were younger was a huge difference, sure. But as we got older, they're like, the gap was kind of closed, interestingly.
Yeah, that's usually the way it goes. Mm-hmm. I really like the way that religion was handled in this film.
Mm.
I like how the topic was brought up from both perspectives, that of a believer and a non-believer. And yet neither side was shown to be correct versus incorrect. Both perspectives were equally respected and disrespected on the same token. And I enjoyed the character that Lonergan played, the priest, and his ability to encourage the idea of, like, well, hey, if you can't get behind God or religion, at the very least, can you try to find connection and value in your life, like, just in the fucking scheme of things? As a staunch atheist myself, who recognizes the good that faith can bring to the lives of good people, I really like the way that that theme was written.
Yeah,
I liked it a lot.
That's a good point.
What was your least favorite part?
I was hoping you would remember. I was, like, really thinking hard about, like, we have to do least favorite first.
Yes, we're flipping. We're flipping.
I kind of hate it when Terry takes Rudy to see his dad. Mm-hmm. It almost feels, I mentioned this kind of earlier, it almost feels like it's not even about Rudy very immediately, and Terry is just trying to show up Rudy Sr. or something. I find it all very aggravating, and this poor kid obviously didn't need to see this fight or see someone who very obviously wants nothing to do with him. It's just like, you just made this worse.
Well, I want to read my note because it's the same, but it's different. I want to talk about it. Yeah, Rudy Sr. I hate that Rudy has to learn that his father is a piece of shit firsthand, and that it's partially Terry's fault. I doubt Terry figured things would turn out the way that they did.
Right.
And only Rudy Sr. can take responsibility for being the world's biggest asshole and for starting the physical altercation.
Yes.
But Rudy will always associate Terry with that memory because Terry was the one who brought it to fruition. I hate that entire situation for both of them because Terry acted with the best of intentions and Rudy was the only honest victim. So, here are my questions.
I don't know what's happening.
When I watch it, in my mind I'm thinking, okay, yep, Terry knows that Rudy Sr. is an asshole. Terry also grew up without a father. Did he think that this is how things were going to end?
Probably not.
When he gets there, like, he honest to God is just like, hey. Like,
he tells him not to tell his mom, though.
Because he knows that his mom hasn't told him a word.
Well, that should be indication enough that you shouldn't be fucking doing this.
I agree.
Okay. Totally. Sorry, agree. I just jumped ahead.
Right? No, I 100% agree this was not his place. 150,000.
I think that's what's most aggravating.
It is aggravating. Like, you listen to the kid's fucking parent. Mm-hmm. As the uncle, not your place. If the kid's safe and it's not a crisis, you don't get to make, like, a call in the moment. That aside, I think he wants Rudy to know and have the knowledge of, like, your mom's amazing and is an amazing parent. This is what she's keeping from you. Once again, not his call. I don't think he thinks it's going to go that bad. He goes there.
I would lean towards that, yes, but he also knows his dad and knows and talks about how his dad acts, and maybe on, like, a subconscious level knows that it could perhaps turn out this way.
So he talks about his dad and says, you know, he's the kind of person that has to one up people and tell a story, blah blah blah. He doesn't talk anything about things like that. It's been, how old is Rudy in this movie? 8? It's been at least probably 8 years since he's seen him. More than likely. Mm. But the things that make me think, like, he doesn't assume, and he should. He should have thought this through many different ways. Like, he gets there and honestly thinks that Rudy's just going to, like, let them in and let them visit. Like, he's just like, hey, we're going to come in. Like, he honestly tries to step into the house. Like, you remember that.
Yeah, yep. And the way that he looked on his face, the way that I took it was just, like, almost a little smug, almost a little arrogant.
Well, I'm sure that he took pleasure in surprising him and being.
And like, it was almost, it was like a really.
Your kid.
It was almost like a really aggressive, dominant move. And to me, that's how I took it. And that's very much, I feel like, that could play into how I, like, took him kind of making it about himself almost. I see where you're, like, trying to go, and I understand. I understand.
Like, I see it, and it was wrong. Like, it was the wrong choice to make, and it was not a good character thing. But the flip side, it's one of those... This is going to be a weird turn. If you're listening to this, and you watch The Walking Dead, and you're, like, seasons behind, spoilers for The Walking Dead, like, early Negan seasons. If you haven't seen the bat scene, just stop listening right now. Goodbye. This is that argument of, is Daryl to blame for...
I'm not saying...
No, I know, but it goes along the same vein, where the way that you're reading it is, who's to blame for this situation? Yep. He made the wrong call.
What part of the situation? He made the wrong call
going, but he didn't start the physical fight. The fact that he told Rudy, don't tell your mom, made me assume that he thought they were going to go, leave, come back, and nothing was going to happen, and this is something they could just keep a secret. Like,
sure, yeah, I could see that. I just, like, what part?
It sounds like you're blaming Terry for the fight.
No, I'm blaming him for making the wrong decision to go there.
He did.
Like, you shouldn't have gone. Like, that's what the issue is. You... Fight or no fight, you went there to do something you shouldn't have done. And the way that I saw it, especially physically, visually, was that you were, like, trying to be a dude bro about it.
I think I feel that a little less than you do.
Okay.
I really do.
Okay.
I don't think he expected as a father to, like, just downright be like, this isn't my kid, he's seen me, goodbye. And I think that pissed him off as someone who had his father taken away from him.
Sure.
I think and that was something he didn't account for. I don't know necessarily that Terry knows how to fucking account for shit or predict things. Yeah. See, you writing about it, you seem like you were, like, your note was a Terry-based note, and, like, mine is just, like, starts out saying, fuck Rudy Sr.
No, yeah, fuck Rudy
Sr. It's, like, an interesting shift of perspective as far as, like,
he shouldn't have done the thing. Like, that's no number one. And then Rudy Sr. just exacerbated this dumb decision.
Another question that I have.
Why?
No, isn't this the point?
No.
Yeah.
What?
This situation, this good intentioned, poorly thought out, horrible decision led to the conversation and Rudy finally fucking finding out about his dad and him and his mom finally having the fucking conversation that they should have had. She sheltered him.
Mm-hmm.
She owned up to it eventually because of Terry doing that.
The kid did not need to see any of that.
And who made him see that? His fucking piece of shit father.
You're correct. But it wouldn't have happened if they should have just stayed fishing.
It also wouldn't have happened if Laura Linney...
Yep. So let's just blame...
No, I'm just saying. All of it wouldn't have happened.
It's just a fuck situation.
Rudy Sr. wouldn't have, like, owned up and been a fucking parent. Like, but...
No, like, it's just...
Mistakes were made.
Yes.
I just found it interesting that my note was more based on, like, Rudy Sr. Your note was more based on Terry. It was an interesting juxtaposition to me.
I just hate that thing happened.
Me too. That was my least favorite part as well. It's just a really interesting, I don't
have the insight that you have, I feel, as well.
I was just thinking, I like to imagine if these characters came into my office.
Fuck.
Like, yeah. Well, and I do that for every movie character, like, things like that. Like, if Terry came into my office, like, what was your intention? What should you have done differently?
Right.
What could you take responsibility for, and what is not on you to shoulder? Like, that would be, he'd be a fascinating client. Anyway, what was your favorite part?
Cool party.
Aww. That's it.
Really nice scene, I think. you really get to see them bond, and I don't know.
Ours are back to back. I absolutely love the scene when Terry and Rudy get busted coming in late by Sammy when she's coming home from her date and they're coming in from playing pool. The fact that all three of them are fighting back laughter when they're on the stairs, and all three of them kind of fail. Terry's awful. We were out doing some stargazing and Rudy lost track of time, which I totally warned him about. Cover up, and him dead ass looking at Rudy and saying, "You are a bad kid." It's also wonderful and feels so genuine and filled with love. I cannot help but laugh and feel as though the actors kind of couldn't help themselves either.
Yeah.
Like that holding back laughter and smile, especially with Rudy, like that moment, like with Rory and Mark, like that felt genuine. Like they couldn't stop laughing. I love that moment so much. It was a good one.
Mm-hmm. I really also like, we've talked about it, like when they're getting high.
Yeah.
That's a good moment. That's just like a really good chemistry moment between Laura Linney and Mark.
Laura Linney in the behind the scenes was just like, I don't have siblings, and this felt as close as I could get. And if I could have a sibling, Mark would be it. Mm-hmm. Like, and I thought that was very sweet. What'd you rate it?
I rated it a 7.
Made it lower than all the critics and audiences.
Yep. That thought went through my mind when you were reading the ratings. It was almost an 8, and I was just like, it just wasn't, this isn't, it was a well-acted movie, and it is well-written, but everything else, for me, just wasn't quite there, and therefore certain things didn't mesh as well despite the writing and the acting being good. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So. Like I enjoyed it. I think I told you that I enjoyed it.
I actually had no idea if you liked it or not. I thought I said
I liked it. I enjoyed it. Even though this isn't quite, as I've mentioned, my cup of tea. Just like Manchester isn't quite my cup of tea. But that's a phenomenal movie. I'm not excited to watch anytime soon. Because it's sad. Y'all, if you haven't seen Manchester by the Sea, oh my god, it's so sad.
It's the saddest movie I've ever seen.
Dredge my heart across the bottom of the lake. Just fucking kill me already. I don't want any more of this. Sadness.
This is a movie that I'm just like, you should watch this movie. Maybe think about watching this movie though if you have children. Like,
we didn't even have a kid at the time.
I was pregnant.
You were pregnant.
It's like recently found out I was pregnant.
We had also watched a bunch of other sad movies.
We watched like Moonlight and Fences.
Yeah, it was just a depressed.
It all in one weekend.
Weekend.
It was really bad.
It was so stupid.
Oh shit. I rated this an 8.5.
Accurate for you.
I love almost everything about it, except there are some, you know, like I said, there are some things that feel, the word dull is too extreme for me. I'll go back to my editing comment, and there are some things that are just fine.
It's very real life.
And which I love.
Life is just fine. But okay.
Knowing that that's the point, I think, is what I like. That's what he was shooting for, and therefore it was successful.
Very well.
And just the editing being fine, and my struggle, I think, with the character of Brian are the two things that...
And Bob.
Yeah, but I think Bob was all intentional, and I think that he was... I think that's the way we're supposed to
feel. Yeah, I know.
Brian just like, feeling confused about a character bothers me. It really does. Yeah. So I think those two things are really the only two things that I really love this movie. Mm-hmm. You said last week, you were just like, can we watch something that's not depressing? And so this was a movie that popped into my head. Because I'm just like, it's not like a, it's not a comedy, but there are funny moments. Yeah, it's not, it's a drama, but it's not angsty. It's like, it's really just like a...
Yeah, it's interesting to try and describe.
I think it's just listed as a drama.
It's like a slice of life drama.
I'm just like,
nothing is resolved.
This should be kind of a palate cleanser, I think, is what I was thinking in my mind.
It feels neutral, just kind of came to mind. It's not, it's not quite neutral, but that's like what popped into my head.
I wonder if it's like, I don't know, like Jeff Who Lives at Home. It's probably
what I really liked.
I didn't know if it was like as close as we've gotten.
No, that's a fair comparison, especially just compared Echo to the movies that we have covered.
I just thought that this was after a couple really heavy ones that this would be a nice panic.
I had to figure out what we're watching next week. I know what we're watching the next time it's my movie week, because we had to order it, and it's going to take a minute to get here.
It's coming here from where?
I don't know where it's coming from, but it's a DVD, and it's a British movie that if you get a Blu-ray, it's region 2, so it won't play here. So the DVD that I found is region 1, so it'll play here.
Yes.
So, this fuck.
Yeah, no, we don't have anything quite docketed yet, I think. You gotta figure out next week, we gotta figure out September, and that'll be in fucking spoopy month, man.
Spoopy.
I'm excited about that.
We have at least 2, if not, I think 3.
October, yeah, we've got 3 down.
We might have to, like, actually write these out to make sure things line up appropriately.
Figure it out. Yeah, my tea has been gone, because my fucking cucumber mint mojito... was the shit. There was some caffeine in there. I hit my third wind.
Jesus. You don't even have time to nap tomorrow. I mean, you could lock yourself away.
I don't, because tomorrow's my first day of school.
Well, that's right. You need a doctor.
I'm not going to have time for anything for the next 3 years. So it's cool. It's been nice knowing all of you. I'll be dead.
Oh, yeah, this is the last episode, actually.
No, it's not. We'll see how this goes. Just expect a slow decline in my mental capacity as the episodes continue.
She just starts like talking about like her papers that she has to write. Leisha, come back.
Not Virginia Woolf this week. Fuck. Anyway, so. My tea's gone. Your tea's gone. You don't know what we're watching next week. We'll figure that shit out. Thank you for 500 downloads. I honestly am worried a little bit about all y'all's mental capacity.
Where can they find us?
Fuck. You can shoot us an email at thescreenteapodcast@gmail.com.
You can find us on the interwebs at screenteapodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/screenteapodcast.
You can find us on Twitter at screenteapod.
Yeah. Who's Kevin Blessen for you this week, my dear?
Rory.
Aw, that's so cute. Yeah. Kevin Bless your best friend, Ken. Kevin Bless.
Lonergan.
Kenneth Lonergan. Yeah.
Kenneth.
Yep. Kevin has some bad dude. Gotta wash me some Manchester.
Yeah.
Gotta, like, do some emotional numbing beforehand.
Jesus Christ. I don't drink. What am I supposed to do?
Suffer.
No, I'm not you. I don't like consuming that much sad shit all the time.
I like feeling.
There were other feelings, Miss Therapist.
Need to feel sad.
Sometimes the goal is to be happy. A majority of the time. Fuck.
Nice reframe. Thanks.
For fuck's sake.
I like happy shit.
Do you?
Do I? Do I?
You like fluffy things.
I do like fluffy things. See?
Is that like a subcategory of happy? That's weird.
Uh-huh. There we go.
You, like, you have not caught your third wind, but are in fact slap happy as fuck.
Slap happy is the version of happy, right?
Sure.
It's in the name.
Names can be misleading.
What? Anyway, goodbye.
Goodbye.